This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A big fundraising haul for Democrat Amy McGrath, along with a well-reviewed debate performance this week, are positive signs for her bid to upset Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in Kentucky's U.S. Senate race. But most observers still agree it's a long shot. Meanwhile, COVID-19 cases continue to mount in the Commonwealth, and even the governor's family had a recent close call. They remain in quarantine. Let's talk Kentucky with Lexington Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRocher. He joins us on the phone. Daniel, welcome back to our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you. And big news for Amy McGrath this week. It's interesting. I spend a lot of time on Twitter, probably too much. Maybe any amount of time on Twitter is too much. But you do see a lot of comments about Amy McGrath from progressive activists who are saying, stop sending Amy McGrath money. There are other competitive races and candidates who could use those funds. But that message doesn't seem to be getting through. She had a heck of a week.
Yes.
Or a quarter.
She did have a heck. A heck of a quarter, yeah. It was between July and September. She raised around $37 million, which is a ton of money. She's raised more than $84 million over the course of the entire campaign. She got in July 2019. And I was, that's a really big number. And so I wanted to kind of check it out to compare it to some of the Kentucky budget. And I found out that $84 million is more than the general fund allocates to public health, or allocated to public health in 2020-2021.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Not that there's been anything with public health going on lately.
Not that there's been anything going on in public health, but they have more of a budget than that. They get federal money, they get other things. But from the general fund, from taxpayer money, that's how much she's raised more than all that is allocated to public health. So that's pretty wild. That's a ton of campaign cash flowing into this race.
It's a ton of cash. How does it compare to Senator McConnell, who's also a fundraising juggernaut, usually, even for other candidates?
Yeah, so she doubled his fundraising haul. He raised around $16 million. And so this is the thing, right? So Democrats have been able to really tap into the kind of grassroots fundraising in a way that Republicans have not. They have this campaign conduit called Act Blue, which makes it really easy for people to donate. And so they've gotten a lot of these kind of smaller individual contributions. You couple that with the fact that Democrats are really, really fired up right now, and were even more fired up after the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That was a big part of the push for why a lot of people had these record-breaking quarters. So McGrath did not break the record set by Beto O'Rourke in 2018 in his Senate race in his fourth quarter, but several other candidates throughout the country did, right? So people like Jamie Harrison in South Carolina, he reported raising $57 million. Sarah Gideon, who's running in Maine against Susan Collins, she reported raising more than $38 million. So across the country, Democrats are bringing in these kind of massive, massive fundraising calls.
And some of those candidates that you reference, Daniel, according to polling, do seem to be in a better position to possibly knock off a Republican incumbent. We're seeing polls that show Jamie Harrison possibly leading Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. You know there's a tight race in Maine. There's a tight race in Iowa. There are tight races across the country. Polling here, and there's not been any maybe in the past couple of weeks that we've seen publicly, it still indicates Mitch McConnell is comfortably ahead. So what are you seeing the McGrath campaign doing with all of this money as the campaign comes to a close?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of it goes on television, right? We're seeing these media buys. I'm sure that everybody's been bombarded by the same television ads that I have. But, and it gets to a point where that gets saturated. And so then the money starts going to other places. So McGrath is paying all of her staff. They all make, I think, if I understand correctly, more than $15 an hour. And so a lot of it's going to salary. And it's also kind of building up campaign infrastructure throughout the state, right? So not only is she donating to the Kentucky Democratic Party, but by having paid field staffers throughout, regions of the state where Democrats sometimes don't compete, places like Northern Kentucky, places like Eastern Kentucky, in theory, that should be setting up down ballot races for Democrats, and it should be building the kind of infrastructure that is lasting. So you kind of see it at that level, right? The party infrastructure, the kind of behind the scenes mechanism that most people never really notice, or only notice when you're getting phone calls or text messages from campaign staff. She is really investing a ton of that and trying to really turn out the vote. As you noted, she was down double digits last time there was public polling in this race. And while turnout operations are extremely important, right? It's like that old basketball thing. Whoever scores the most baskets will win. Whoever turns out the most voters will win. But turnout operations, you know, they usually don't make up a double-digit gap, right? Like, they can make the difference in a race like we saw with Bashir and Bevin, where that was decided by 5,000 votes. But they tend not to do as much in races where the chasm is really big.
And to your point, Daniel, we'll note that Amy McGrath was in Covington just yesterday, opening up a new office. So she is making the rounds in a place like Northern Kentucky, where Democrats are not known for their competitiveness. And this week...
So the Northern Kentucky thing, the Democrats see Northern Kentucky as like a huge place where they can pick up votes. And that has to do with national trends, right? So when we look at the national trends right now, the suburbs are really the place where Donald Trump and the Republicans are slipping. And so because of Northern Kentucky being the largely suburban area of Cincinnati, Democrats see that as kind of ripe for the picking. Whether or not they can really twist that is left to be seen.
So we're talking with Daniel DeRocher, a reporter at the Lexington Herald Leader, and Amy McGrath and Mitch McConnell appeared on television in a debate this week. That was, gosh, everything feels like years ago. Was that Monday? It's been several days. But Amy McGrath's performance seemed to be pretty well received. And does there appear that maybe she could get a bounce from her performance?
So I tend to be of the mindset that debates don't really make that big of a difference, right? People tend to watch them to cheer on their side, and they're not really making up their mind. This race has kind of remained relatively steady since McGrath got in it. That said, the interesting thing about that debate is that I feel like for the first time, you know, she's always had these dissenters among the progressive base in Kentucky, and it felt like for the first time those kind of progressive dissenters shut up. And so that might make a difference with, you know, encouraging them, making them feel more comfortable about voting for them, where they may have been more, not necessarily reluctant, but less enthused to go out and vote. Maybe it reassured them and helped kind of shore up that base. I don't know that it necessarily changed minds, but I do think that she came off pretty strong in a way where she usually has struggled in debates. And she seemed to be very prepared for Mitch McConnell's talking points. She had her kind of set lines that you knew she was going to get in there. And I think that Senator McConnell was on the defensive, right? When you look at the situation in Washington, D.C., he doesn't have a ton going for him in terms of the news of the day, right? Like the coronavirus relief package is stalled. The president came down with COVID-19. You know, they're in the midst of this Supreme Court hearing. So, like, there's a lot going on there. And so it kind of made him ripe for attacks from her.
And I spoke with Senator McConnell earlier because we are having Amy McGrath and Mitch McConnell on this program on Monday. I've recorded our interview with Mitch McConnell already, and I got to ask him some questions about things that he raised in that debate that I guess personally found curious. This weird notion about Puerto Rico in two different instances, you know, concern that Puerto Rico could become a state and concern that Puerto Rico was going to get more money than Kentucky in a COVID-19 relief package. And I asked who what his concerns were about that. He didn't have much in the way of a response. And you cover politics certainly more than I do. What do you gather the messages from this emphasis on what could come from Puerto Rico becoming a state or possibly getting a few more dollars than Kentucky in relief? I mean, Puerto Rico was on top of the pandemic, hit by a pretty devastating hurricane.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I think it's one of those situations where he's kind of very in the thick of things in Washington, D.C., and is focused on the things that he is in the thick of in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure. Maybe it polls well with the base. I don't think so. I think that it's more of a power thing, right? So if Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. were to be made states, Democrats would, in theory, get four additional seats in the Senate. And it would make it very difficult for Republicans, the way the electoral map is now, to pick up a majority in the Senate, right? So and that's a matter of power, right? And this is the argument that Mitch McConnell has been trying to make the whole campaign, is that he is the only leader that is not from California or New York. He says it over and over and over again. You know, it's this idea that if you
vote him out of office, you lose that sort of representation in middle America. And I think that that's what he's trying to say. But when things get kind of filtered through the lens of Washington, D.C., sometimes it can be like, why are you talking about that? And that could explain your feelings there.
And that's what Amy McGrath tried to hit him on in that debate, it seemed, on Monday, was like, well, here he is saying these things. And how is it working out for Kentucky? Did that seem to land?
There's a lot to I think it probably did land. And there's a lot to pick on him there, right? Like, because we're in the middle of a pandemic, the economy's not going great right now. And Kentucky has traditionally struggled in regions like Eastern Kentucky and in health metrics. And there are a lot of places where Kentucky has struggled. So when your whole campaign is about how much clout and how much influence you have, it does make you very vulnerable to those types of complaints. At the same time, McConnell has been touring the state, bringing paychecks to small businesses, hospitals, all of these places, reminding them, well, look, I was the guy who helped orchestrate the CARES Act, who helped get this money for Kentucky, right? So he's still, you know, it's this argument. I mean, I hate to bring up Hamilton, but like, it's that he's in the room where it happens. And he's trying to make this argument that she would be a freshman senator. She would not have the clout that he has after being there so long. And, you know, it's the idea, you know, when you talk to the McConnell campaign, it's about, they're trying to pitch him on effectiveness. They're trying to say, look, he has been effective. He has been able to deliver the money, deliver the goods for Kentucky. And he's been able to deliver a conservative agenda. That's part of the reason why they talk about Supreme Court justices so much, right? That he's been able to deliver a more conservative leaning court as well.
Why do I get the feeling you're not actually unhappy to bring up Hamilton?
You know, I got to get a Broadway reference to shut down.
And we're talking with Daniel DeRochers from the Lexington Herald Leader. Again, we will have Mitch McConnell and Amy McGrath on this program on Monday, so you'll hear more from each of those candidates then. But Daniel, COVID-19 is really spiking in Kentucky, and we've seen these consistently high numbers since the middle of the summer. They're strikingly high when you think back to the early days of this thing, when it was quaint that we were all staying home and watching these numbers sort of trickle in. And now they're an absolute avalanche, and we're still all out there in society mingling in ways that would have seemed unfathomable back in March or April. And what's the lay of the land in Kentucky as it relates to COVID? We know the governor's own family is in quarantine still.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely seeing an increase in cases. Things are going up. Yesterday was actually a really grim report, right? So we have the highest number of people who are in the hospital ever. We have the highest number of people in the ICU since, I think, May. We had our positivity rates creeping back up towards 5%. And, you know, the second day in a row where the governor's announced more than 1,000 cases. For a while, I've been basically blaring this horn. The governor's been underreporting cases in Kentucky. And as his system becomes more streamlined, it feels like he is catching up a little bit, especially in Fayette County, where he had been several months behind. And now he's only about 100 cases behind in Fayette County. So that accounts for it a little bit. So every Monday and Thursday, I go through the Facebook pages and websites of all 61 local health departments in Kentucky. And I can tell you that this week, it feels like there is a lot of growth in cases throughout the state. And it's not necessarily pocketed into specific regions. It's kind of all over the place. You know, some in Western Kentucky, some in Eastern Kentucky. It's basically that this virus is out there and it is spreading. And because of the kind of economic implications of shutting everything down, it feels like politicians are really, really reluctant to pull the trigger on putting back in place those restrictions right now. It's this really weird position where, you know, months ago we would have been kind of shaking our heads at why bars haven't been shut back down, why they haven't done anything to restaurants, especially as colder weather is coming. It may just be politically inviable right now. I don't know.
I picked up some tacos a couple nights ago, walked into the restaurant, and for the first time during this was really scared of my surroundings because the restaurant was quite crowded. And, you know, obviously when you're eating, there are no masks, and it's just so strange to see all of that. And we're seeing Western European countries with their own spikes responding with similar shutdown measures that they took early in this thing. I guess, though, you're not hearing any rumblings at all that the state is interested in revisiting those things.
It does not feel that way. I mean, any time that it's been brought up in these press conferences, it's almost seemed like he's extremely reluctant to do that again. And you have to remember, I mean, he got sued for shutting them down the last time. So there's also that whole threat. And as much as we would like politics to not influence these decisions on public health, we are less than 3 weeks away from an election. I think any type of drastic action that any kind of politician would take right now in terms of shutting down the economy would be filtered through that lens, and it would be kind of ugly. There's also a little bit of people are set in their ways, right? People have kind of decided how they're going to act during this pandemic. You have indicated that you're a little more careful about this. Some people are a little less careful about this, right? And at this stage in the pandemic, is anything that the government going to do really going to change the mind of someone who doesn't wear their mask when they go to Walmart? Is it going to change the mind of someone who's throwing a house party a couple feet away from the college campus? I don't think it does.
Well, stay safe out there, Daniel. I'm so glad you took some time to talk with us today, and hope to have you back on again soon. Daniel DeRochers is a reporter with the Lexington Herald. Leader Daniel, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The transition to virtual learning has brought challenges to most families, from adapting to new technology to making sure there is childcare. But for some families who face a language barrier on top of it all, education in the age of COVID is particularly difficult. WCPO recently looked at such issues facing local families, and we're joined now to talk about it by reporters Paolo Suro. Paolo, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you could join us. And your co-author on this report is Lucy May, who joins us via Zoom. Lucy, welcome back to our show.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
So, Paola, this was such a well-done story and told an angle that has seriously gone underreported, because we all know that there are frustrations in general with what's going on with having to teach kids at home as part of what many perceive as keeping them safe during this COVID-19 pandemic, child care and learning the technology and that sort of thing. But gosh, adding that language barrier on top of it has got to be a struggle. Tell us a little bit about what you found. I mean, you reported about a mother who found a son crying.
Yeah, absolutely. Lucy May and I were lucky enough to speak with two mothers who gave us their very own point of view. And they spoke to us in Spanish because they don't speak English or hardly speak English. And so, you know, it was almost a very emotional interview to do with them, because they told us it's very frustrating to them because they can't really help their kids through virtual learning because they either can't speak the language or there is that barrier when it comes to using technology and internet. And sometimes the internet's not working, or they don't have the appropriate technology to be able to help their kids through this time. And also just problem solving is harder when you're doing it over the phone versus that one-on-one help that you get at school or with your teacher. And, you know, a lot of the two moms we spoke to, they said it was very frustrating. They always feel like they want to cry because they can't help their kids during this tough time. You know, it's hard for families who do speak English, and having that language barrier just makes it a lot harder. But yeah, Lucy and I were able to find resources that these families can either use or have been using, but it's still very challenging when you've got that language barrier. And I'm lucky enough to be bilingual and speak Spanish and English, but can't imagine what it's like when you are not able to speak the main language, English, you know. It's been hard. These mothers also tell us they're scared their kids are falling behind right now.
Paola, tell us what those resources are that these families have been able to access that you indicate still don't offer a perfect solution yet.
Sure. And Lucy May wrote this beautifully on our website, WCPO.com. But there's this woman, Linda Villapasione. She used to work for the Kent County School District, and she actually just got a grant that will allow her to teach students whose first language is not English and teach them in a one-on-one setting to help them with schoolwork or whatever it may be. And this woman, she is so very passionate about this because she is bilingual herself, and she has seen these kids struggle firsthand, and she told us it's a disaster just how it's all been during this time. So she has been a resource, or will be a resource, for these families. But we also spoke to Santa Maria Community Services. They're in Price Hill. They're located in Price Hill. And the Wellness and Immigrant Outreach Director. Her name's Luz Elena Schemmel. We've talked to her before in some other stories. They are working on getting grants to help get these families some hotspots so that they're able to get the necessary internet to work on these classes. I mean, she told us that there are families right now, there are students who are crossing the street to go to another home and use other people's Wi-Fi right now because they don't have the Wi-Fi to be able to connect and do their classes virtually. So that's why Santa Maria Community Services are trying to get these hotspots so that these families are able to get the internet necessary in their homes. And I know Lucy also spoke to Cincinnati Public Schools about what they're doing and how they are releasing information in multiple languages, not just English, not just Spanish, but also French and Arabic. So I know she can talk a little bit more about that and what CPS is doing for a lot of students, because they do have students who speak multiple languages, not just English.
That's Palosuro from WCPO. We're also joined by her co-author on this report, Lucy May. She's on via Zoom. Lucy, to see a school district with a component that looks to help students who do not speak English as their first language, it's commonplace these days in districts all across the region. How are districts adapting those resources to this remote learning environment?
I think it's been kind of tricky for districts. Paola mentioned that I talked to some folks at Cincinnati Public Schools, and CPS, I think, has tried to work pretty hard to make information available to parents in multiple languages. There was a video town hall in those four languages that Paola mentioned a few weeks ago to try to help parents understand what was going on in terms of return to school and remote learning. They also kind of pivoted earlier this school year. The district has, Cincinnati Public Schools, has a hotline, a technology hotline that parents can call to get help with these connections and Google Classroom and all these meetup things that parents are and their students are trying to figure out. And after hearing back from some of the school sites, the district put a Spanish language option on that hotline. So it had been all in English, which was not working for some families. So the district did make that change to try to pivot. But I think what as a mom, and fortunately for me, I'm an old mom, my daughters are not dealing with this. They're in college and graduate school, so they can figure it out on their own. But as a mom who used to have young kids, what really broke my heart talking to these other moms is that they don't even feel like they can properly advocate for their children, from what I understood, from what they told us. You know, when you can't speak the same language as your children's teacher and principal, and you don't have a lot of connections at the school, it makes it harder to stand up for your child when they are having those crises. And you want your kids to be able to do a lot of that on their own. But sometimes as a mom, you also want to be able to step in and say, hey, this is what my son or daughter needs. And that's really difficult with this remote learning and without having English as your first language.
Lucy, for the past 6 years, I've volunteered as a mentor at Covington Partners, and the student I've worked with all these years is the child of immigrants from Guatemala, and of course he speaks English perfectly, but his parents do not speak English, I mean really hardly at all. We always have to go through a translator when we're setting up things outside of school. And so I was wondering, are you seeing, based on this reporting, that the struggle as it relates to this language barrier, is it more difficult for the students, even those students who do speak English, than it is for the parents who don't, or is it harder on the parents?
From what the moms that we talked to and the advocates that we talked to told us, I think it's pretty hard for both. It's a difficult challenge for the kids. I mean, the moms told us, and Paola, correct me if I'm remembering wrong, they told us, my kids don't have any problem with this. They speak English, they understand. But the kids then end up sometimes being translators for their parents, which is another kind of stress to add to the kids. And for the parents, yeah, it is. It's a huge frustration not to be able to help your child and advocate for your child in the way that you would really like to. Paola, I don't know if you have other thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I was also going to mention that as both of the mothers we spoke to, they even mentioned that they don't have the high level of education that their kids are getting. And so even if they did want to help, and even if they spoke the language, they're not able to help them because they don't understand, for example, the math problems that their kids are learning right now. So, and that's something else that the educator that we spoke to, Linda Villapassione, mentioned. She said, you know, a lot of immigrant families that we are working with, they don't have that high level of education to even be able to help, if even if the language barrier wasn't there.
You know, I know my parents are helping my brother's kids during this time. They don't know the math either, and they are fluent in English. I know that must be a very challenging mm-hmm. situation. But Paola, let me ask you, what do you think the region, and this is a dumb question, I apologize, but what do you think this region is learning about itself and its non-English speaking population through this remote learning experience?
Yeah, I think, you know, after speaking to everyone for this story, I think we're learning that we don't have the necessary resources on hand to be able to help all of these families. I think we're learning that this region is more diverse than we think it is. And now is the time to really step up and help these families more than ever, because the situation is so much harder right now. And I think we're all, even the school system, is realizing and opening their eyes, like, you know, this is something that we need more help with. We need more educators who are diverse and who speak more than just English, who are able to help these students firsthand. And I mean, even if that's something that we might not be realizing, I hope we do open our eyes and see this, because every student deserves that opportunity to be able to help and learn, even if English is not their first language.
And Paola, we'll note that WCPO produced this article in English and in Spanish. Can you just talk about the technical side of that process?
Sure. That's something I think is very important, because of how our, you know, we just talked about how a lot of people do not speak English, they let alone read English. So Lucy May and I interviewed the mothers in Spanish, and then we interviewed the experts in English. And so I had, I did the whole TV portion of that story, or the web story, we translated it to Spanish. So I basically grabbed Lucy May's web article that she beautifully wrote, and I translated it to Spanish for the web, so that, you know, these families know where to go. They know where these resources are, who to reach out to in order to get help. Because of course they can't really read the article in English. And then I was able to send the Spanish written article to the mothers we interviewed, and they said it was very, very helpful. So that was an important, you know, next step for us, to be able to have this resource in Spanish so that they're able to access it.
And this is something you're going to be doing more frequently, Paola, and I don't think I'm out of line doing this. You posted this on Twitter, and so we are losing you here in Cincinnati. You are headed to Atlanta. Sorry, Lucy. We're losing Paola. You're going to Atlanta to work as a bilingual reporter and MSJ. Yeah. Tell us what an MSJ is for reference.
Sure. It's very similar to what I was doing here at WCPO. Here it's called MMJ, Multimedia Journalist. So I get to shoot the story, edit the story, and write the story. So I basically do it all. And I got to do it here for a little bit. I got to do it with this story, and I'm very passionate about doing this. So basically I will be taking the stories I'm working on and turning it in English for TV, and then writing it in, as well, in Spanish for the web. So I'll do the web article in Spanish, but also I will do a small TV portion for the website as well. And it's funny, because sometimes I need someone to translate the English interview to Spanish so that I can have it, you know, as the video portion in Spanish. And so I'll need, you know, I'll call my dad and I'm like, Dad, I need a man's voice, you know, in Spanish. And so he'll translate it for me. And then my mom will do, you know, the women parts in Spanish for our website, our TV portion for the website. So I'll be doing a lot more of that in Atlanta. But of course, Cincinnati has been home for more than 3 years, so I'll miss it very, very much. And I'm very thankful for this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Well, we will miss you.
You can still stay.
we know Lucy's position on this. When I tried to book you guys, she almost made me cry in her response. So, well, Paola, we do wish you the best in Atlanta. We'll say goodbye to you. Lucy, hang out, because we've got a couple more things to talk about. But Paola, good luck in Atlanta. We'll look forward to seeing your work. Thank goodness we live in an age where we can watch the news from Atlanta.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Paola.
All right, Lucy, can you go on? Can you keep it together?
I'll try.
Well, we've got a good story to talk about, and it involves pets. And I know people love pets, and it's pandemic pets. And there's some funding available that's going to help people keep their pets. What can you tell us?
Well, this is a program that the Interfaith Hospitality Network of Greater Cincinnati has had for several years in a different capacity. IHN started this their pet program a number of years ago because they realized the families that they were trying to help through homelessness were really upset about the thought of having to give up their pets. IHN specializes in family and helping families who are experiencing homelessness. And the idea was, hey, you know, these families have lost their home. The kids are in upheaval. They don't want to give up their beloved dog or cat or rabbit or turtle that they've had for years. It's just an added trauma. So IHN started this pet program with their clients in mind. They expanded it and have been helping with the help of local animal welfare organizations, other people, individuals and families experiencing homelessness. And now they've just recently gotten a grant from PetSmart Charities for $50,000 they can spend over the next year to expand this work and really help pet owners who are struggling financially because of the COVID-19 crisis. So these people do not have to be on the verge of homelessness. They don't have to be facing eviction. But there are so many people right now who are really struggling financially because of this crisis. And, you know, if you've got a pet and you really love that pet and you've got to decide, do I buy food for myself? Do I buy food for my pet? Do I take care of my pet's medicine? Do I take care of mine? Those can, you know, it might sound crazy to somebody who doesn't have a pet, but if you really love your pet, those are tough burdens to have. So this money is available to people throughout the area who are struggling financially because of COVID-19, and they can get help with things like pet food, pet vet bills, medicine, even pet deposits for apartments if they have to move and they need to come up with that extra $200 or something for the pet deposit. So I was really excited to do this story. We heard from some pet owners who have been helped by this program. And I think it'll mean a lot to people to have that little bit of burden lifted during this very difficult time.
I was so moved to read the quote from Dwight Player, who is participating in this. And this is someone that you interviewed. He's 73 years old. He became homeless after falling behind on his rent due to some financial difficulties. He did find another home for his two dogs, but he didn't want to give up one of them, this British Staffordshire. And he just said, I don't want to give up. I'm not giving up my only friend. And yeah, that was just really hard to read.
Yeah, it was really, Mr. Player was such an engaging and personable man, and his dog is as friendly as he is. His dog was being friends with all of us while we were doing the interview. And you know, he really choked up when he started talking about the possibility of having to be separated from this dog. And the lady that we interviewed for the story, Michelle Ross, she was separated from her two little tiny dogs for 5 months. And she was just, this one little dog just sat on her chest during the whole interview. And she's an Army veteran. She has PTSD. And she said these dogs keep her stress levels way down. And she said, I just don't know if I could have survived thinking that I wouldn't be able to reunite with my dogs after being homeless. So, you know, pets mean a lot to people. And I think it's great that there's this new resource to help people keep their pets. And when the pets are that important, that helps the people too a whole lot.
That's Lucy May from WCPO. Always has great stories to share with us, though I think we're going to have to fact check that she has children in college and graduate school. I don't believe that for a moment. Lucy, thanks so much for spending part of your Friday with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Michael. Great to talk with you.
And up next, one of the reporters held hostage by a gunman at WCPO 40 years ago. He's with us. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. 40 years ago, a gunman with hundreds of rounds of ammo took over WCPO-TV right here in Cincinnati and held 9 people hostage, including reporter Tom McKee, who joins us now via Zoom. Tom, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Michael, thank you for asking and having me on the program today.
It's our pleasure to have you. I know a lot of our listeners remember you fondly. You've only been retired for a little while, so they surely still appreciate all of the journalism you did over the decades here in Cincinnati. And this is such a fascinating piece of news history in Cincinnati for a lot of reasons, not the least of which because it involved the news industry directly. And our John Keysweater, our media beat writer here at WVXU, just profiled this event again on the occasion of its 40th anniversary. Tom, would you take us back to October 15, 1980, when over the Rhine resident James Hoskins held nine of you at WCPO hostage?
Yeah, I'll make a brief recap of this event, which was quite amazing that all of us got out alive, but the details are as follows. It was about 1:30 in the morning. I was producing the 11 o'clock news for Al Shabakati at the time, and after the newscast, I was working on election preparation, producing election coverage, getting ready for the upcoming election, since I was the election producer at the time, and I heard the buzzer on the TV station's main door sound. I went, took a look, and I saw Elaine Green at the door, so I buzzed her in. Elaine Green and John Earhart had been at General Hospital, what UC Health was known then. They had been at General Hospital doing a story about a possible kidney transplant. Well, the story fell through, and they were coming back through the parking lot back to the station when they encountered a man in the parking lot who was just wandering by, passing by. He had a paper bag under his arm, and they said hi, and he said hi, and all of a sudden he heard the words, "Hold it." They turned around, and he was taking the paper bag off the front of this semi-automatic weapon. So going back to Elaine being buzzed in, the next thing I do, that John Earhart and Elaine Green were being escorted into the building at the point of a gun. I was about 30, 40 yards deep into the newsroom at the time. I asked permission to come up and see if I could possibly do something to disarm him or whatever. And it was quickly apparent that that wasn't going to happen with his build and his stature. It would have been silly to try to do something like that. He wanted to make a statement on TV about the lack of media coverage of the poor people in the Over the Rhine, the people that had nothing, that he could see from his window at 12th and Vine Streets, a third floor window in what is now the Gateway Quarter area. Well, Elaine didn't want to have him do any kind of statement, and she told him that there nobody was there who could possibly put the station on, so she suggested a taped interview. And photographer Earhart left the building, went out to his news car, came back in with a camera, and a 13-minute interview ensued. And again, he was talking about the media does nothing about the poor people, how that the court system was oppressive to blacks and to poor whites, about how we don't need leaders at the time of Reagan or Carter or anybody like that, that the people need to be more of a democracy because we don't have a democracy.
And then
he dropped a stunning piece of information.
Yes,
oh,
I was just going to say,
why can't you be helped? Because he says, "I just murdered my girlfriend. I shot her. She's dead."
And Tom, we've got a little clip from WCPO, from that interview from reporter Elaine Green interviewing James Hoskins. And let's hear James Hoskins' own words in this interview.
Jim, we have probably another minute or so on this tape. Is there any other point you wanted to make?
I can't think of any point I want to make, except give me a place where the police can come and get me. We're going to shoot it out. And you people can leave. Well, I don't see any other place for me to shoot it out. They've got their magnums. They want to hurt the poor people in the street. I've got my magnums. I'm ready. I'm loaded.
And so, Tom, there are a few things there that he says in this 13-minute-long interview. One, he's ready to have a shootout with police. Two, you learn that he had killed his girlfriend before coming here. And three, he suggested that he was going to let you all go. Did you believe him?
In those kind of situations, there's no playbook for coming across a person with a gun holding you at his will. I believe that I had to believe him, if you want to make it very, very clear. I thought that it was one of those things that if we didn't have a positive attitude and try our best to keep everything calm and on an even keel, there could be a problem. So to a certain extent, we had to take him at his word. But again, when he admitted that he killed his girlfriend, he had just confessed a murder to us. We were material witnesses to a murder at that particular point. And you have to realize nobody outside the station knew anything about what was going on inside the station. Nobody knew anything at all until we actually did leave as a group and go over to District 1 in the West End and report what was going on to the police there.
When did this interview ultimately air? You said that you had nobody to put the television station on the air at that time, but you did shoot this footage. When did people get to see it?
Well, the first people that saw it were the SWAT team members, the SWAT team commander, Dale Menkhouse, Captain Dale Menkhouse at the time, and the brass of the Cincinnati Police Department. And, of course, Channel 9's general manager, Bob Gordon, Al Shadokati, a number of people who were involved in this whole thing of trying to get the station back on the air. Because when I left the station, I told Mike Bowden, who was our engineer on duty, to go to black. In other words, turn off all the video. I didn't know if we left that Hoskins would know how to get on the air, so I didn't want to take a chance that he could. So the challenge was to get back on the air. That was the challenge for Channel 9. The challenge for police is what to do about this situation. And James Hoskins, the interview, was a key piece of evidence, information, that they could get an idea of who they were talking about to begin their investigation. Yes, they sent teams over to 12th and Vine and did indeed find that Melanie Finley had been killed. Her body was in the third floor apartment over there. And then they basically waited him out. Dale Menkhouse was on the phone with Hoskins quite often. He was the chief hostage negotiator. And he remembers talking to him a number of times, and Hoskins was absolutely stone cold. He had admitted killing the girlfriend, but didn't seem remorseful or in any way, shape, or form without it. And Dale said that while he was on the phone with Hoskins about 9:30 in the morning, Hoskins made some comment about, well, that's it. And then he heard a shot, the phone drop, and that was it. Hoskins took his own life inside the stations. So that was the end of the situation. It was about 2:30 when the station was opened back up. That was after police made a sweep to make sure that there were no explosive devices or any booby traps inside that could harm anybody coming into the building.
We're talking with Tom McKee, a retired...
Al Shadokati stood in his desk.
I'm sorry, Tom, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think we had a brief interruption in the broadcast, but we are talking with Tom McKee, a retired reporter from WCPO. He is sharing his memories from being held hostage along with eight others at WCPO 40 years ago this week by a man named James Hoskins, who ultimately took his own life. And Tom, this video, this interview that Elaine Green conducted with Mr. Hoskins ultimately won a George Foster Peabody Award. We'll note that Ms. Green passed away in 2014 at the age of 73. But this event must have been something that stayed with you all probably still.
Yeah, it's the thing that most people, if they find out that I worked at Channel 9 and they find out about this, they definitely want to know more about what happened that particular night. I'm sure that's what everybody was asked by friends and family members and whatever about what was going on. The stress obviously was very high. I was able to talk it out with so many people that wanted to know so much about it that it didn't really bother me as time went on. But stress is a real problem for journalists and first responders back then and even now. Last night, we had a program, the Society of Professional Journalists had a program we entitled Journalists, First Responders in Stress, Coping Mechanisms in Unusual Times. And we had Dale Menkhouse on there. We had Tim Garrity, the WKRC News Director, and Mike Cannon, WCPO Senior Director of Local Strategy, plus Dwayne Pullman of Channel 12, the Chief Investigative Reporter, and Kara Osley of the Enquirer, the director of photography. And this topic was stress and how to handle it. And the expert we had on was Dr. Kate Chard, who is with the trauma recovery center at Cincinnati VA Medical Center, and she's director of the UC Health Stress Center. Now, she also helps out with the Cincinnati Police Department on conducting seminars and conducting individual assessments of people who think they need help. But her main message, and the message for everybody, is stress happens. You've got to deal with it. You have to admit that it happens, talk it out, or get assistance so it doesn't physically harm you as well as mentally harm you.
Tom,
you made that point very clearly.
Tom, you've been in the business a long time, and though you've retired from WCPO, you're still heavily involved with the Society of Professional Journalists Cincinnati chapter. Do you find, and have you found over the years, that while we talk a lot about the mental health issues in other professions, that within journalism itself, we're not so, considerate or aware of it?
I think most people are aware of the stress, but sometimes they don't know where to turn, how to deal with it. Both Tim and Mike made the point that in recent years, they've made it more of an effort to watch out for unusual behaviors, perhaps, or changes in behaviors of staff members that might indicate something's bothering them. Mike Cannon made one point that a producer at the station was kind of upset and traumatized by the Fifth Third Bank shootings several years ago. His behavior changed quite dramatically. People noticed it. They talked it out and things were put back on an even keel. But that's where talking and listening can help out. Both Channel 12 and Channel 9 have employee assistance plans or something along that line where people can get help anonymously through the corporation if they so choose. But again, it's the tough part of admitting there's a problem and then going on from there to get assistance to make things better. Kate Chard mentioned a program they have right now that is specifically designed to handle stress or post-traumatic stress disorder, that with sessions that last 10 to 12 weeks, she says most people can be brought around to where they feel more comfortable again. Are they cured? Are they normal? Well, that's up to the individual. But there's a program in place that's being used, I'm told now, with Cincinnati Police and available to anybody that handles questions for the UC Health Stress Center.
Tom, obviously the industry has changed. We've got about a minute left. The industry has changed so much in the way that we deliver news. It's not just, TV stations aren't just TV anymore. They're online with websites and obviously social media as well. They're doing podcasts and all of that. Do you think that all of these different delivery methods and the way we as journalists, professionals in this industry, have to constantly be bombarded with this information, does that take a toll too?
I think it does. And you also have the factor out there with the fake news and the media is the enemy of the people. If you're on the street, whether you're being a reporter or a photojournalist, you might get a double look from somebody who might be absolutely believing that the media is the enemy of the people. And you have the other side, you have people that praise the media, keep doing your job because it's important. So yeah, that kind of dichotomy does create stress in people. And again, it's that stress that has to be dealt with, or it can cause some not only mental issues, but as I mentioned, physical issues as well.
Tom McKee is a retired reporter from WCPO. He is now with the Society of Professional Journalists, Cincinnati chapter. Tom, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. This theme music was composed by Rob Fetters, and we've got archives online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.